This is Out of School, a podcast at the intersection of technology and education. My name is Fraser Spears, joined as always by Bradley Chambers. Tonight we have two sponsors for the show. Jam Software, our friends who make the Casper Suite MDM server for Macs and iPhones and iPads. And Aerohive, makers of great cloud-powered Wi-Fi that keeps our schools running, keeps our iPads up, and keeps everybody happy. We'll tell you more about both of those as the show goes on. So let's get into it, Bradley. How's it going?
That's a good week. We are approaching Thanksgiving, so we get the whole week off for Thanksgiving. Please don't try to take back over America during that week. Would be great.
Nobody's looking.
Yes. Well, it's always funny that, you know, we like, and again, I know this is just like when you live in a country, you think the whole world is about your country. But like some of our holidays just aren't the same. And it's kind of odd to me because I don't know many people that don't live in America well enough to know their holidays. And because when we're trying to coordinate, you know, recordings, things like that, it's like our just holidays are different. Because I was thinking that, you know, Thanksgiving falls on a Thursday, which is our normal record day. Well, mm-hmm. I mean, that's just another day to you. It's not really a holiday. And that's a big holiday here. So, of course, then it kicks off Christmas shopping and Black Friday and then quote unquote Cyber Monday, which I don't get that nowadays because it's like we have high speed internet. Never mind. Well, we have it at home. So, yeah.
Yeah, it's like there's a day that you shop, you know.
Yeah, well, it's like because you went back to work and you had high-speed internet at work, and so...
Why it was the Monday.
Yeah,
because... In the 1990s, right?
Yeah, when you had, like, dial-up at home. Of course, it seems like that the Christmas sales start earlier and earlier, like you're already seeing kind of, you know, pre-holiday sales. So, yeah. But, yeah, doing a good week. That's a roundabout way, but we're having a good week. We finished our accreditation visit this week, and we passed. I'll say we are recommended to pass, like, the accreditation team, which is made up of heads of schools in the surrounding area, like other cities. They are recommending to our accreditation body that we be reaccredited. So it's been a two-year-long process, and so it was really fun on Monday and Tuesday to be on your very best behavior.
Yep, shirts and ties for everyone. iPad Air. Did you get your iPad?
I did. But I have not taken it out of the plastic wrapper because my case hasn't come in. So I've used it, but it's like I use it every day, but it's like still in the plastic. And I know that's ridiculous. I realize that I should take it out of the plastic wrapper, but my case has not shipped yet, and I'm very annoyed by that. But
there's nothing worse than damaging a brand new device.
Well, especially when you don't have a case, like you feel like it should have just been patient. But I'm quite impressed. One of the things I loved about the Mini is that I could hold it with one hand. And I really feel like with this that I can hold it with one hand. It's like the perfect size. I don't know how to explain it any better. I had forgotten how much I missed the Retina display, and it's incredibly fast.
Yeah, I mean, to me, the thing that's just... continues to really impress is the performance. I'm more of a desk kind of iPad user, maybe not so much sort of sitting and holding it and reading, but I've been traveling this week. I was in London on Wednesday and just got back on the sleeper train this morning as we record, and on that trip I just took my iPad because, well, didn't need to take anything else. But then got off the sleeper train, went straight to work, realized I got to work and I had no Mac, and I've kind of been tweeting today about just a kind of acid test, if you like, of living with the iPad. And in fact, I only ran into maybe two things that I had to do during the course of the day that were really awkward with the iPad, if not actually impossible. One of those was I had to duplicate a file in my Dropbox so that I had a copy in my public folder and one in the folder that it was in. And the Dropbox app on iOS doesn't let you duplicate files. It just lets you move them. So that was... I had no idea that was true. I just found it because I had to go that way. The solution for that was to log in to the Dropbox website where you just select an item. And there's a big fat copy button at the top there. So that was no problem. The other one was I had to make a fairly complex edit to a Google document. And although I was sort of able to do it, like I could type in the text that I needed to add to the document, I couldn't get the formatting and the sizing to work correctly, either through the Google Drive app or through either of the desktop or mobile versions of the website that lets you edit those docs. So I ran into those two roadblocks, if you like, or speed bumps. But apart from that, it was a dead straightforward day. and perfectly fast and comfortable with the iPad Air in hand.
You know, the Dropbox app for iOS really feels long in the tooth at this point. Mm-hmm. And of course, I don't know if you saw the Dropbox blog yesterday, but one of the big glaring things that they're missing that Evernote actually has is the ability to do like a business and a personal login. And so that Evernote has that, and you know, it's had it for a while now. And Dropbox, you know, they have the Dropbox for business or Dropbox for teams. And mm-hmm. some of the people at our work have that. And that's one of their big complaints is they have to like kind of log in and out, and they end up accessing their personal one through the web. And on the Dropbox blog, they mentioned that they're working on basically multiple sign-in. It'll be coming soon. There's a way to keep like your camera uploads only go to your personal folders and things like that. And on the page, you get a screenshot of what appears to be their iOS 7 update. And so, you know, the app's kind of been stagnant for a while. And mm-hmm. so I guess they're about to update it. But I use Boxy for Dropbox on the iPhone, and it works really well. And you can do things like cut and paste files mm-hmm. and things like that. So, yeah, that's glaring.
I had a couple of workarounds for that, or I tried a couple of workarounds, neither of which really worked. But one was to try I've also got Documents by Readle on my iPad and also iFiles. But neither of them seemed to really offer a kind of duplicate feature. I mean, what I could have done in GoodReader, for example, is download the files and then re-upload them to Dropbox somewhere else. But, you know, it was 700 megs of iBooks documents, so I didn't want to have to do that if I didn't have to. So the solution, which was probably the quickest thing, was just to log into the website and do it. But it's interesting also, I was just going to say that the recent update to the Google Drive app also added support for multiple logins, which is pretty cool. It's not the easiest thing to find. It's not quite as slick as some of the other ones. You've got to kind of go two levels back in the navigation to find the list of accounts, but it works, and you can certainly access both of those pretty easily.
Yeah, that happened as we were recording last week, and I got a text about that. But yeah, it takes about one too many taps, as I feel like it should, but I guess it's better than nothing.
Yeah, it's not designed for easy flipping between accounts as much as for I guess the possibility of sitting down to a session in one account or another. I believe the Gmail app just got an update as well that makes it easier to flip between accounts in Gmail, so maybe that'll come to the Drive app as well.
Yeah, I hope so. I actually downloaded the Documents iPad app this week, and I'm surprised that it's free. I was really surprised that, you know, the re-edit docs, I don't know. I was surprised that there's no in-app purchase, there's no nothing. It's just flat out free.
Yeah, I'm not sure what's going on with that. I mean, Readle are the people who make PDF Expert, which is one of my favorite apps on iPad. It's an absolutely fantastic PDF editor. And I believe version 5 for that is on the way, if not actually out yet. I don't think it is out yet, but I'm looking forward to that when it comes out as well. That's my kind of go-to app for PDF work. And, of course, I do a lot of PDF work with, you know, course notes and different things. So that's a great app for sure. I don't know what's happening with Documents at the moment. I don't know if there's a new version coming or not.
That would make sense that they would make the current one free if they were about to release a new paid one. That seems to be a lot of companies' strategy, and as a telltale sign that they're about to release a big update.
Yeah.
How does interacting with your Casper server from an iPad, how is that?
It's a really great question. It wasn't super easy with Casper 8. But since Casper 9, it's been much, much easier. So mainly what I do with that is I have all the passwords and stuff are very complex, obviously, because there's a lot of value stored in there. And what I do is I log into 1Password, and I use 1Password basically as my web browser to manipulate that stuff. But since Casper 9, one of the big features in Casper 9 was to get away from a very kind of desktop-centric UI, and it's now got a kind of responsive design interface. So when you log in on an iPad, you basically see the desktop interface, and the performance is great, and it works really well. And I haven't found, well, I guess the one thing that would be difficult is if you had to upload a VPP spreadsheet. But as we know, that problem's going away quite soon as well. So everything else you can do, you know, manipulating configuration profiles, pushing them to new devices, creating groups, things like that, modifying searches, it all works perfectly from an iOS device. And if you hit it on a phone, you get a sort of phone-orientated interface as well, which is great. So very, very pleased with that.
That's interesting, because it would. I could see a situation when you would be out in school and need to make a change or need to check something, and so it definitely should be optimized for specifically the iPad. I would think that would be a natural way to interact with your Casper instance.
Yeah, and it's handy just to go and look at your dashboard, for example, where you can see the sort of push status of various configuration profiles and so on. So it's a handy check there as well. And of course, the Aerohive dashboard, to mention our other sponsor. The Aerohive dashboard is now basically flash free as well, which is great. And you can, I did part of that today. I had a pupil had an additional computer they needed to put on the network, so I had to make a new password for their computer. And I was able to do that from my iPad. So I logged in through 1Password, went to Aerohive, added a new user, and then rebooted all the base stations all from my iPad. So those kind of things, even what you might have considered complex sysadmin tasks, a year or two ago that you would have really wanted a Mac for, don't need it anymore.
Well, and this really kind of, when we talk about cloud services, this is why I love that. It's because you can be anywhere and not have to, kind of VPN into a network or try to get inside your network. It's just you're accessing something that's out there. And, of course, I know your Casper suite, it was with Amazon currently. You can access that from anywhere in the world.
Yep.
Make it so happen. So before we kind of move on, I am building something that I don't build things. I'm not very handy. I did repair my son's tricycle yesterday with a replacement part, so I will give myself props for that.
Progress.
But yes. So I have been wanting to do a standing desk for a while. I feel like I have bad posture, and I just get tired of sitting down. Well, I had my boss talked into going down to IKEA and letting me buy a desk, like a $200, $300 desk. Well, then I came across an article. It's a $22 IKEA standing desk, and basically, ended up with shipping and buying an extra piece of the hardware. I ended up spending $44 after tax and shipping. But I'm going to build an addition on the top of my desk that has a keyboard tray and a spot for my laptop and my second monitor as well. So I'm going to be converting my existing desk into a standing desk for less than $50.
Interesting.
So if my laptop falls and breaks, we'll know why. Mm-hmm.
Or on the other hand, you could just switch the iPad for everything and walk around holding
it. That's true. Just stand at the kitchen counter.
You are the standing desk.
What kind of really sold me was, I guess it was maybe one night last week. For some reason, I had in our kitchen, there's kind of a, the countertops, there's like kind of a bar stool area. Mm-hmm. And I had my laptop there, and I stood there for at least like 45 minutes writing something. And I thought, this is nice. Like, I should do this. And it reminded me back when I was in college and I worked at it was EB Games at the time, but they were bought by GameStop. It's like one of the major video game retailers in America. And so I worked there during college. And then when I got kind of a real job and sat at a desk all day, I gained 15 pounds overnight. And so I thought, like, I might like to stand up again. And so I'm going to try that. And I may hate it, but it seems to be the trend.
Yeah, the next step's a treadmill desk.
I don't know about that. I think people would make fun of me. My office is too in the middle of things at school. I think people will probably think I'm crazy enough with the standing desk. Of course, I can tell our teachers that I just want to be one with them because they stand all day.
True.
So
yeah, they certainly do teachers that.
So let's talk about Jamf real quick and take a quick sponsor break. Again, we've mentioned Jamf before in this week and in weeks past. The Casper Suite, it's a great addition to your iPad deployment, and really not even an addition. It's integral to a one-to-one deployment now. We've said for months now the MDM is just a core competency for your one-to-one deployment. So if you're deploying Apple technologies in your school or in your workplace, this includes Macs, iPads, iPhones, and Apple TVs, Casper is the one you want. And they actually have a great feature called Casper Focus that works with the Guided Access API that Apple has. That allows teachers from their iPad, this is not for the IT staff, this is for teachers, to take control of their students' iPads. They can conduct secure exams. They can select specific Apple TVs. They can choose and distribute iBooks. And they can even initiate AirPlay right from Casper Focus, again, from their iPad. This is built into the Casper suite. So version 9, as you said, we're on Fraser, and so you can optimize for the iPad. You want to learn more about them, go to jamfsoftware.com, jamfsoftware.com. Again, this is the company you want to look to if you're deploying Apple technologies in the workplace. So thanks for them for sponsoring the show.
Yep. I think 9.21 just shipped recently. I have not updated to that yet. I'm still on 9.1 at the moment. But everybody's kind of waiting for somebody, one MDM vendor, to ship their managed distribution support. I don't think anybody's there yet, but it's definitely on the way. I think we'll talk a little bit more about that later on in the show. You mentioned Apple TV, Bradley. I was going to throw in a thing there. I finally put one Apple TV under MDM control. It worked.
How was it? It was a pretty easy process.
Well, with the latest version of Configurator, what you do is if you plug in an Apple TV, it comes up with a special assistant that you don't otherwise see, and it takes you through a series of steps. You've got to provide a configuration profile that gives the Apple TV a Wi-Fi connection, and then you give it the MDM profile. So I had a generic enrollment profile for all my devices, and I just used the same one for the Apple TV. There was no difference there. But I had to make a special Wi-Fi profile so that the device could get a network connection and then obviously enroll in the MDM. So it certainly worked. I can search for it in my Casper installation by model type. I can search for an Apple TV and find it there and so on. I guess it worked. I mean, the only thing I know to sort of do with it at the moment is it shows up in Casper Focus. So if you're a teacher, what you can do is you can grab a pupil's iPad and have it begin doing AirPlay to an Apple TV that's also under Casper's control. So you can sort of pull somebody's screen up onto the Apple TV that way, rather than having the kids do it themselves. Although, you know, having the kids do it themselves has never really been that difficult or that much of an issue in the school. But, yeah, that's what I know to do with it so far. I mean, obviously, I certainly hope that more features will come to Apple TVs through MDM. Naming them, various things like that would be really helpful, and setting up some of the options, in particular deploying the restrictions. Because I don't know if you've deployed Apple TVs, Bradley, or what you've done with them, but we, as part of the deployment, go through and turn off all of the channels, just so the Apple TV is essentially just an AirPlay receiver for the television or the projector that it's on. So that's something I would like to be able to automate if I can for future deployments.
Yeah, we do the same thing. And of course, I think we're moving that way because now that we have auto updates for software updates, that's nice. We've not had an update since that came on, so I don't know how quickly it would work or when it's going to do it. But, that's a nice feature, and that makes me think that we'll maybe get some more of those controls going forward. Because I would think that if they weren't planning on doing something like that, why would they even build an API for it to do anything with an MDM?
Yeah, it does kind of feel like at the moment there's not enough capability in there to make it really worth the effort of putting it in under MDM control, and B, the actual cost, because I don't know about other MDM vendors, but certainly Jamf are saying that if you enroll on Apple TV, that will eat one of your licenses in the MDM. So I'm paying $5 a year to be able to find my Apple TV in Casper, which is not really good value at the moment. But if that started to do more in the future, that would probably be worth the money at some point. But it's, to my mind, it's not really worth it right now. Until the Apple TVs can have a little more done to them over MDM without having to actually plug them back in.
Right. So 7.0.4 dropped today, and I want to cry.
Just an hour ago.
I just finished updating 81 iPads through Configurator to 7.0.3. And this is not, it's not that it's hard, or it's not that it's particularly time consuming in itself for me. But our iPads only come to me when they need charging or on Fridays. Mm-hmm. So I get them about 3:30 on Friday. And this means I usually leave between 4:30 and 5 on Friday, if it's a good day, maybe even 4:15. And so that means I have to go to work updating these things through Configurator. And mm-hmm. I don't know about this update, but 7.0.3, it still wants me to create a passcode for the device. And so I have to, on every single iPad, tell it don't add a passcode, and then I have to go in and turn Bluetooth off. And some of them I leave Bluetooth off because I know they won't be using AirDrop, so I just want Bluetooth uses 2.4 gigahertz, so just trying to eliminate some interference. Just takes forever, and I know what's Apple's option here. I know, but it just makes me sad.
Yeah, it's I think as far as I can tell, the 704 update doesn't present you with another setup assistant. I just did it on my phone just before we came on the air, so it just seems to come back to the lock screen again. So that's at least a little bit of effort saved. But I've been in the same position as you, just trying to catch up with 703. And I did 14 or 15 iPads just this morning with 703, and there we go, 704. So it's almost like I don't think I've had a weekly maintenance window yet for our managed iPads that we haven't had an OS update to do as well, which I guess is good given that. iOS 7 has a few rough corners that we would be very happy to have sanded off. But it's kind of like painting the fourth rail bridge. I don't know if you know the fourth rail bridge, Bradley, but it's a very large steel-constructed railway bridge in Scotland. And the legend for many years, and it wasn't even a legend, it was actually true, was that it was just continuously being painted all the time. So by the time, it took like a year and a half to get from one end to the other, painting the whole structure, and then they would have to go back to the start and paint it all again. So, the Scottish phrase for a Sisyphean task is to compare it to painting the fourth rail bridge, because you're just never, ever done with it. But I think last year, actually, they invented a new kind of polymer paint that lasts for like 10 or 15 years or something. So they finally have actually, chemistry has caught up with them, and they finally have actually finished painting the fourth rail bridge. So hopefully, eventually, they'll invent that kind of paint for iOS, and we'll be stable for a while.
I guess you saw that the iBooks update is out as well.
Yeah, and iTunes U. So those just dropped as well. They're almost indistinguishable now once you're looking at the UI. It's for those of you who haven't seen it yet, they're just kind of plain white. They almost look like the newsstand UI with the kind of white gradient sort of shelf things. So very plain looking. Not apparently very many features added apart from the new user interface. So it's kind of still a similar functionality to what it was before. But obviously those are the last major Apple apps, I think, not to have an iOS 7 update. And now they're in the fold as well. Is there anything else outstanding? I don't think there's anything else that I know of.
Remote was updated. Keynote remote.
Keynote remote. And the poker game as well.
Oh yeah, yeah. I remember
when's that getting updated for iOS.
Yeah, seriously. I don't know. Well, I mean, it's one thing to not be updated for iOS 7. It's one thing not to be updated for the iPhone 5
or iOS 3.2.
Yeah, I remember the original iPod games and like the golf game and Texas Hold'em, and I had those back on the Clickwheel iPods. Mm-hmm. And that's got to be a tough UI to build for, or a control to build for, is a touch wheel.
Yeah, I think they built all the games that could possibly be built for that interface.
Yes. It was pretty neat because the iBooks update dropped while I was at lunch. I took a half day from work so I could get a propane tank installed. Of course, the guy ended up rescheduling, so that was great. That took a half a day off, and he didn't come. But so we went to lunch, and I had my iPad in my bag with me, and I got home and opened up my iPad 5 minutes later, and it already updated iBooks. So that was pretty impressive that, like, within the 5 minutes of being home, it updated.
That's pretty cool. I have not figured out the rules for when automatic update happens. I can't get a grip of it. You seem to be able to trigger it by opening the App Store or something. I'm not sure, but that was another question I had recently when I was at school yesterday talking about iOS stuff. They had a couple of Apple TVs, and one of the questions was, well, when does the Apple TV do its software update? The answer is obviously I don't know yet because it's never done one. But I don't know how you deploy them, Bradley, but we deploy them with a 10-hour sleep time so that teachers have to turn them on first thing in the morning, but then they're on all day so people can find them, and then they go off sort of after hours and so on. But if it's sleeping during the night, will it wake up to do a software update, or do we need to set that to never? I don't know yet. I need to find some documentation about that.
I guess before we move on with our listener feedback, let's thank our last sponsor, Aerohive Networks. Actually, I had lunch with my Aerohive SE yesterday. We were talking about the the SE over in your part of the world, and they were just raving about him. Mm-hmm. Ben Wilson is his name, right?
That's his name.
Yeah, yep. they're talking about how great he is. He comes well recommended. But Aerohive, if you don't know, they reduce the cost and complexity of today's networks with cloud managed Wi-Fi switching and routing solutions for enterprise, for medium sized businesses, for retail, for branch offices, and of course education. I've been an Aerohive customer for close to 2 years now, and very, very satisfied. They have an award winning cooperative control architecture. You know, I was talking to my systems engineer from Aerohive, and we were talking about, you know, when you do things radically differently, like Aerohive, when they started this controllerless trend, and you know, other companies are getting into this, when you do something radically different, you need to explain the technology, especially in the enterprise. And so you have some wireless companies that do things that are kind of non-standard, and they won't explain to you how it works. And that kind of makes me nervous. But that's not the way Aerohive is. They've got, you know, incredible documentation and white papers on their website about their cooperative control architecture of how they do what they do without a controller. So you can do public or private cloud. So if you want to host your Hive Manager instance on site, you can do that on an Aerohive appliance or a VMware server, or you can just let them host it. But it's a management system. It doesn't actually do any controlling. So if that piece of equipment goes down, your AP still functions 100%. So this eliminates single points of failure and bottlenecks. So this gives Aerohive's customers mission-critical reliability with granular security and policy enforcement. So we're talking about the idea of doing a branch router with an air card in a bus, and one of Aerohive's customers actually came up with like a little pack to send on a bus and actually send overseas when they it's a church when they do mission trips. He had like a little pack that has a branch router built in along with a 20-hour power inverter or a battery pack. So it like literally have Wi-Fi in a bag.
That's pretty cool.
So again, if you want to learn more about Aerohive, it's AEROHIVE.com, Aerohive.com, and we will have a link to them in the show notes. So thanks for them for sponsoring the show.
Yep. Love me some Aerohive. I'm currently tracking how we talked last week about caching server 2 in Mavericks. I'm currently using the Aerohive dashboard to track how that's taken down our traffic to iTunes over the Wi-Fi network. Don't have a good number just yet because it's still settling down a little bit, but it seems to be working a little bit. And obviously, as new apps and new updates come down, it's been a little bit of a quiet time for updates for the apps that we use. But obviously, there's going to be a big chunk of people downloading the new iBooks and the new iTunes U this week. So we'll see how that goes for them and how the caching server fits in. But very, very helpful set of diagnostic tools in Aerohive. And love that stuff.
Yes, yes. So do you want to read the first email?
Okay, so we're going to go through the mailbag, if you like. And the first email comes from a gentleman called Adrian Abbott, who his feedback says, "Your show is brilliant." So thanks very much for that. Actually, he says a little bit more than that, but I like to bring that one out at the start. He's asking about the managed distribution feature and volume purchase. And in particular, he is talking about how you can download a token from the facilitator account, which is the volume purchase portal, and link it into Profile Manager through OS X Server, but he says it's not totally clear what happens after that. It seems even free apps can now be managed through volume purchase and managed distribution, but again, it's not clear how to do that. And furthermore, it doesn't, at first glance, seem possible to upload more than one token to the NDM server, which seems to invalidate a deployment that has multiple facilitator accounts representing different schools in a district. Am I missing something? Bradley, are you using multiple facilitator accounts? Are you even clear on what they are? I'm not that clear.
Well, so this is the idea of let's take a step back on volume purchase programs. So you have two accounts when you apply as a school. So you have a manager account, and then you have a facilitator account.
Yep.
So the manager account. So let's think about public schools. And so like the public school near us, they have a what they call a county office, and then they have obviously schools. And so they have like a head guy at the county office that's, I guess, like the COO or the CTO. Then they have, for example, an IT person or a tech coordinator or facilitator on site at every school. So the CIO would be responsible for actually setting up the district's volume purchase account. So this is not typically done on a school by school level in a district. Mm-hmm. So that person, the only job of a manager is to create facilitators. So, okay. You know, for like in our school, I have a manager account and a facilitator account, even though it's simply me. Mm-hmm. Those can never be changed once you set them up. So you don't want to use like your email. You want to use like, I just created VPP manager at BrainerdBaptist.org or VPP facilitator. So I guess being referenced is when you've got multiple schools and you've got multiple facilitator mm-hmm. accounts, because you know that way, let's say you give this school $5,000 school wide in the volume purchase program, you give them a voucher, they redeem that voucher in their facilitator account, and then they're only accountable for their things. They're not having to share a pot, basically.
Yeah.
And so that's the idea of the different types of accounts.
Okay. So the question that Adrian's asking then is, He's sort of saying, well, if you've done that and individual schools have school facilitators, but you've somehow got one MDM for multiple schools, he's running into a problem with that. I think, and it seems to me that what they need to be doing is having one MDM per school.
Yes, I would say so.
Yeah.
These are those situations that... You know, I was just thinking today, and I meant to tweet it, and I guess I'll do it later. But like when you think back to fall of 2010, and you think how differently an iPad deployment looks then than it will in the fall of 2014, which I guess mm-hmm. is most when if you're planning a new deployment is when you're planning for, how yep. different that looks. And it seems like every year it's like things change and it makes it harder if you are already kind of doing something. Like if you were just starting out in 2014, I feel like that like you're finally at the place where you have all the answers to all your questions.
Yeah.
And up until now, you've had to make compromises and you've had to do mm-hmm. things that maybe you don't totally understand why you're doing them, but you have to do them to make it work. And certainly thinking back to your original deployment,
yeah.
you just bootstrap it. Because there weren't Absolutely. Answers to these questions. Yep. And I think what Adrian's running into is questions for which Apple has not even given us answers yet.
Yeah, like what is the optimal structure of device deployment versus school organizational structure? And in some ways, some of the things about volume purchase and these different roles and accounts, there you can make multiple mappings between those and the kind of organization that you have in the school. And I think what Adrian's running into is if that mapping does not match up over time. So as capabilities change and features change, the mapping of roles, VPP roles to school roles can become out of sync and have to rebalance that a little bit. Obviously, having one MDM per school, depending on which MDM you run, of course. I mean, if you're running OS X server, then it's not going to be a huge cost either way. To put in a couple more, apart from maybe the hardware costs. But if you were running an MDM that was licensed per installation, then the cost on that's going to ramp up a little bit. And of course, in either case, the cost to reconfigure that is going to be pretty high in any eventuality. So, I mean, it's something we're looking at as well in terms of what are we going to do with all of our... we've got one Casper suite installation for the whole school, but we've also got a whole bunch of codes in Apple Configurator. Now, we've said in the last show that you can migrate those codes, but are we doing that at the right level? You know, how do I manage? Obviously, a lot of kids have already got a lot of apps redeemed. The codes are redeemed in their accounts. So I'm going to have a chunk of kids for quite a few years now who have got, they own some of our apps, and then the rest of them are going to come through managed distribution, and how are we going to handle all of that? So there's going to be, obviously, a legacy of a former deployment for us as well, and that's going to last a lot longer than previously as well. I mean, obviously, when you refresh devices, you kind of get to a natural boundary where you can start to change things again. But it's obviously, the other thing to say is that it's not absolutely necessary to switch to managed distribution. You don't have to. The existing system is going to continue. But obviously, there's a big financial benefit to doing that. So perhaps the calculation there is to look at the cost benefit and say, well, if I can keep control of $5,000 or $10,000 worth of software, and it costs me $1,000 once every 5 years to license an MDM to make that happen for every school, then maybe over the course of the period, that's actually going to be a good deal. So you can put actual numbers on this as well and see if that makes sense for your school.
Yeah, I mean, and Yeah, that's true, because it just depends on how your deployment is, how your financial situation is, how often you're turning things over. You know, this is it's one of those kind of legacy decisions you have to make.
Yeah, and it's, you know, when you put in place a large program, there's going to have a legacy and there's going to be a tale of, you know, old ways of doing things and so on. And I think, you know, in some ways, the harder you can make the breaks, the more you can change quickly. So, for example, when we refreshed our iPads in the summer, we said, look, these iPads are going away. They're going to be securely erased. You're only going to keep what's in your Google Drive, and we're going to redeploy after the summer. And I'm actually looking at, based on our configurator experience and the possibility of managed deployment, I'm actually looking at the possibility, if jams ship in time, of redoing our primary school deployment over Christmas to move some or all of them to purely managed distribution, just to get some experience with that. I'd probably start with the youngest kids who have the least data and the least sort of investment in the content on their device to work with them first. But it's a tricky one, because it is a wee bit of an all or nothing situation. You've got to say, well, all my code's over to managed distribution. So I think actually, even as I'm saying that, I'll probably have to, if I am going to redeploy with managed distribution, I'm going to have to do it for all of the primary kids at once, which is like 5 or 6 classes worth. So that might be a busy Christmas.
Yes, yes.
Okay, so yeah, basically, I'm afraid the advice there is get more MDMs or more instances of your MDM. But also, I mean, the thing I would say to anybody who's in that situation is send feedback to Apple and tell them that you're in a situation where the current setup doesn't work for you. And maybe the best thing to do is to speak nicely to the right people at Apple and wait, rather than try to rejig the entire world for what is obviously the first iteration of a new service.
That's a good point. I mean, that's, you know, we often think that Apple is a kind of like the empire from Star Wars, but it's people. And if you talk to people and let them know about your situation, and it's maybe a situation they haven't thought about, and then maybe they can make course corrections along the way.
Yeah, absolutely. Yep. I mean, everybody's learning, right? And I think the thing is that a lot of people looking in from the outside can think that Apple has a master plan that's going on for years and years as to how this is all going to work. But down on the ground level, they're absolutely reacting to what's happening, both inside other parts of Apple and outside as well. All right. Who's next?
Robert. I think he emailed you directly.
Yeah, this was an email that we got and back when we did our first kind of iOS 7 show after the release shipped. I think you and I both kind of had a little pop at the iOS 7 folder design, considering it to be a bit of a waste of space on the iPad because it takes up just that square section in the center. But Rupert Stubbs emailed to come to the defense of the iOS 7 folder design, and I think actually on reflection, he's probably right and I was wrong. I'll just pull out some of the important points that he makes, but the first one that I really liked was that the iOS 6 folder design was rubbish anyway to start with. I certainly have a lot of sympathy with that point of view, because obviously you had the 3x3 grid in the icon, but inside, you know, in a landscape iPad, you had a 5x4 grid of apps, so the layout inside the folder didn't actually reflect what was on the icon. And of course that's been fixed in iOS 7, so that you now have the small icon is a zoomed out representation of what you'll see when the folder's open as well. So the point he makes about that is that enables you to look at the icon and then tap it, and then what comes up for your further investigation is an exact replica of what you already looked at. So your ability to find and target an icon once the folder opens is greatly enhanced, because you don't have to re-parse the list of icons that you can see after the folder opens. And I don't know what you think about that, Bradley, but I certainly agree with that, as that's something that I've found myself thinking about more as I use iOS 7, trying to find those apps.
It is a difficult problem to solve, because we are trying to, it's legacy. We have our old way of doing things, and what's the best way forward, and trying to bridge those. And it's like, there's no perfect way.
Yeah. I mean, I find myself kind of frustrated and also kind of in love with the iOS home screen. I mean, I think it's wonderfully simple, but it's also, I can't quite get my hands around it. I've never found one layout that I really like. A little bit more so on the phone because, you know, the phone I'm using fewer apps more often. So I get a bit more muscle memory up on the phone, and also the fact it doesn't rotate. Mention that in a little minute. But on the iPad, I've never quite found the exact configuration that I like. And I think in truth what it is that at different points in the year, I use my iPad very differently. So when I'm in the summer holidays, iPad much more of an entertainment device, reading, content consumption, Netflix, all that kind of stuff comes to the fore. Go back to school, it's very much more of a work device. And I think in some ways I'd like to have kind of two ways of looking at my apps, if you like. Rupert also makes a case that the paging inside folders is incredibly useful. He says, the ones you use most often go in the first page, the nice-to-haves on the rest of the pages. And if you really have more than 9 apps, you can always make 2 folders if you want. I agree with that. What I found, I don't know if you found this, Bradley, but I found that apps that are in the second page of a folder tend to get lost, and I sort of forget where they are.
Yeah, I'm that way too, and that's why, especially on the phone, I've ended up with Spotlight, and I don't even know why I even kind of keep, you know, different folders. I've kind of settled on 3 at this point, but I don't know. I mean, again,
it's really interesting you see that, yeah.
Yeah, on my iPad, I don't use Spotlight as much, and I don't know why. But I go back to there is just like when even I would like almost the folder to be like another home screen in terms of size. And I don't know. I wish I could do like a video of what I want it to look like. But like I'm, you know, hitting my iPad, and I have a folder called Frequent, and in some ways, I feel like when I tap that, I should see the same number of icons that I do on my home screen. Like I should see maybe not 5 rows, but I should see 4. I shouldn't see 3. Like there is room for a 4th row.
Yeah. Although one of the points that Rupert makes in this is he says also that the new folder design is orientation independent. And it is because it's a square right in the middle of the screen. So whether you're holding the iPad landscape or holding a portrait, you get the same square. And I like that because that was one thing that drove me kind of nuts with... It still drives me nuts with the iPad home screen as a whole, but the fact that when you're in portrait, it's a 4 wide, and then when it's in landscape, it's 5 or 6 wide, whatever it is. That drives me nuts because things move around and you can't develop any muscle memory. And at least with folders... The folders are, it's the same 3x3 regardless of whether it's portrait or landscape. So I have a lot of sympathy with that point of view, which is cool.
Maybe this is stupid, but maybe an option to like increase the number shown. I don't know. I mean, I just feel like that, I don't know. I know he's got good points, but I guess I just want what I want and I probably should just get on the new way. That's the new way. So I just need to deal with it.
Steve says it's not the customer's job to know what they want, so.
I know, but like I don't know. Like I just, especially on my iPad too, like I just see so much empty space, and why am I having to, I don't know. Like why am I having to then on a screen that is like very large, when I tap a folder, I am seeing 9. Why it just blows my mind on the iPad. Even so, why can't I see like the equivalent of another home screen? Like there is so much room there.
I mean, in some ways, that's what the iOS 6 folder design was. You know, you could see most of, apart from one row at the top, which was sort of your context for where this folder opened from, you could see, you know, 3 or 4 rows of icons inside that folder. But at the same time, you then have that problem of orientation. Yeah. I guess this is why we're not user interface designers.
That's true. I would just scream at people all day long. But and again, maybe again, there's an old way and there's a new way. And obviously, this is the way forward. And it's just like with file systems. You just, you know, when you're a little old school, I guess, then you just have to deal with it and move on. But he makes great points. I mean, he really, really does. And I agree that it is awkward on the home screen. Then when it rotates, things move around. I agree with that. But I don't know the answer. Again, why we are not user interface designers. I would scream at people all day.
What if the home screen was square?
Yeah.
one of the things, I don't know about you, but I've certainly found myself using Spotlight a whole lot more on iOS 7 than I ever did on iOS 6 and before.
Yes, I go in there and turn off everything but applications. I don't want to search my email. I don't want to search contacts. I just want to see applications. And so
I have not configured that, but I probably will.
Yeah, almost treat it, make it where it's just like an application launcher, like a Quicksilver or an Alfred, which I know those things can do many more things, but I just want to be able to do that. Of course, on the iPad, I guess because you can see more apps on the home screen, I have the apps that I use most frequently, you know, kind of actually on the home screen, and you can have more, you can have two more apps on the dock as well on the iPad. Yeah. So, but no, on the phone, like I use the heck out of Spotlight. What I don't like is how Spotlight, let me see, I'm going to test this. Like if I search for an app and then like don't launch it, or even if I launch it, okay, so if I type in SPO, it's
going
to ask
me. I know
where
you're going with this.
Like it doesn't, like it remembers that the next go around. Like it shouldn't remember that. Like it should go back to like blank.
There is some kind of timeout in there where if you go back to after say like 20 minutes or half an hour or something, it's clear again. And I can't tell how long that is. And of course, there's no way to set it either. But there's something else that needs to happen in there. I'm not sure what. Feels like if you found what you're looking for and you successfully launch it, then perhaps that should be a signal that that job's done. It's time to clear it. But I think you know when you come back to it and the thing you've just your completed task is still evident in the interface, then I think that could be cleared out a little more usefully as well. But it's really great in the classroom. And the thing I use it all the time in the classroom is because the kids' iPads are all set up differently. They all personalize the location of everything. So if I want to look for pages or even just to see if a kid's got pages installed now, which is not something that is always guaranteed, I can just use the Spotlight search from any home screen as well, which is cool. And you don't have to sort of laboriously navigate back to, you know, close a folder. But now I'm on the fourth screen, then I've got to go back to the first screen, and then I've got to go one screen beyond that. It's much, much quicker to get to and solves the problem pretty quickly. So that's probably my favorite enhancement to the home screen in iOS 7 is the way you get to Spotlight now.
Yes. And again, he's probably right. I'll admit that. But maybe I'm just like crabby, I guess is the word. I don't know. I just want what I want. I don't know. But, you know, I think we've come a long way when this is what we're complaining about.
Yeah, I mean, we're down to fine points now, aren't we?
Except, there is a low-hanging fruit that Apple has got to address, and I blogged about this yesterday. Okay, let's imagine, let's say that there is no Mac. You don't have a Mac. Okay, let's say, like, you have an iPad and iPhone, which, you know, often we could make the case that you could easily do that. Mm-hmm. Let's say I have a PDF. Okay, let's say I have no third-party apps, okay? And I have a PDF on a website or an email attachment, and I import that into where? iBooks. Well, I guess that's a third-party app, but you have to download it separately. But let's say you could only use Apple apps.
Yep.
There is no way to take that PDF like into iBooks. It does not sync anywhere. Why does adding that PDF not sync it to iCloud and sync it to your iPad? Mm. PDF Pen does it. Documents by the folks at Riattle does it. You know, you can do it over Dropbox. Mm-hmm. And again, over iCloud. Like, why, you know... And Kindle doesn't really do this any better because they do have like a send to Kindle app for the Mac, and they do have you can you know email into your Kindle database, which is more than iBooks has. But it's the databases are siloed off almost. Of course, on iBooks, the way is to sync it over iTunes. But again, like it drives me nuts. Like if you send me a PDF, I add that to iBooks, I then have to sync it to my Mac, and then sync it to the other devices and. To me, that just seems like, why are we still doing this in 2013?
Do you know what's really interesting, though? If you add an EPUB file to two iOS devices, it will sync the position between them.
I know. Blows my mind.
Even though it won't sync the file, and you didn't get the file from iBookstore, you may have sideloaded that EPUB file from something you made, perhaps, in Book Creator. It will actually sync that, because I believe, I'm no EPUB expert, but I believe there are sort of content identifiers in there that can uniquely identify parts of a book or a title itself. And it will keep your place on side-loaded books, but it won't actually sync the book content itself. I'm going to go with lawyers, which is kind of my default answer for everything that kind of sucks. or copyright, perhaps. But Yeah, that would be a nice addition.
But again, it's like a third-party app uses Apple syncing technology and storage to do what iBooks cannot do. Because there is no preview app on iPad. So like on the Mac, you know, the default PDF viewer is the preview app, and you can save documents into PDF Pen's iCloud container, or not PDF Pen, but preview app's iCloud container.
Yep.
But where does it go? To another Mac? Yeah. Mac, I guess. Like if you had two Macs, it would be there. Mm-hmm. But it's like there is no built-in way to deal with PDFs on iOS.
I think there's a pretty strong case for a preview on iOS. Just a simple PDF reader and annotator that is not iBooks. Now, having PDFs and iBooks is great, and I can totally understand a really good use case for just reference materials and being in the same place as textbooks and other books. But I think, Adobe Reader is okay. It's just okay. And PDF Pen and PDF Expert are much, much better. But they're actually they are towards the higher end of the price for iOS apps. But I think there is a good case for some kind of basic thing that's like Adobe Reader's level of capability, but designed by Apple. Let's put it as simply as that. On iOS, built in, built in. I'm not going to say from the App Store, but built in. That would be a really great addition, both for schools and just for the general populace as well. I think.
Like if I get a PDF from the web and add it to iBooks, it should be on my iPad. Like I don't for the life of me, I cannot understand why that's not that way. It's like the feature must be there, but they forgot to like implement it, and people thought they think it's in there, but like it's not. Like it's like turned off somewhere.
The guy who was doing that feature got hit by a bus.
Yes, or it was the same guy that was building the exclusive Mobile Me dashboard widgets. Or no, was it .Mac dashboard widgets? One of the two.
Oh my goodness.
They never remember. You remember those? Like that was
You're
like it was
in gray beard mode tonight, Bradley.
Yes. So moving on.
I was going to say one more thing about that, and I've totally forgotten what it was. Oh, this probably doesn't matter. Yeah. Bring on preview for iOS.
Yes. Okay. Last question. I'll take this one from Trevor Nelson. First, let me say how much I enjoy your show. Although I'm not in the IT/EDU space, I find what you two are doing is very interesting and highly informative. And the thought that goes into what both of you do and the challenges faced is very educational. Thank you, Trevor. It's very nice. Which brings me to my question. As this IT and education is still a relatively new field, how or what do you think is necessary for someone to move into the sector? Do you think it's more IT/tech knowledge or more of an educational focus with an understanding of IT? Curious as I see a number of schools moving towards this type of deployment, but I can't imagine there are a lot of specialists or consultants to call on. Witness Fraser's constant demand for speaking and consulting. A follow-up question to that would be, do you think schools should have its own in-house IT specialist, someone that designs and maintains the deployments, or does a consultant/contractor model work? Thanks for all you do, all your work on the show. So, you know, we'll tackle the first part first, obviously. Mm-hmm. So I have neither of those trainings. Really, I don't have any formal IT training. Well, I didn't before I came to my job, nor did I have an educational focus. I was just a Mac specialist, I guess. I didn't have any major networking skills. And I went to school for business, and I worked in telecommunications before that. And I just kind of fell into the job because I knew the headmaster. It's not that I wasn't qualified, but it's just that what I knew had to do what he wanted, which was to operate and basically manage Macs. And so that's how I kind of got the job. Offered it to me over Facebook, nevertheless. I don't think I've ever mentioned that on the show. But it is very difficult because, again, let's say you started a BS degree for iPad deployments in 2010. Let's say that was available. Well, how differently does that look now? And you just got to think this what we do changes so quickly. Think about if you were like a wireless expert 4 years ago and you basically quit learning. How does that fit today? What's drastically different? And so I don't have a great answer. I think you can get into it either way. I think if you're an IT person and you're a strong sysadmin and you get a job at a school, you can learn the iOS deployment and the educational stuff. And I think if you have an educational background and with a knack for computers, I think you can learn the other way. I think there are multiple paths into our jobs.
Yeah. I suppose I would agree with that. And I think one of the things that is readily apparent right now is that people who are in IT, whether they are working in education or whether they're working in a corporate environment, very, very few of them have the right mindset for iOS. Vanishingly few. And I think in some ways, I would rather take somebody who didn't have an IT background and teach them the IT, but who had a real heart for what goes on in the classroom and a sympathy with the job of a teacher and the role of a learner. I would probably rather take one of those people and teach them the IT skills than try and take somebody who's in IT and make them really care about the classroom. And I'm not saying that can't be done, and I'm not saying that there aren't people who work in educational IT who care about their customers, but all I can say with my hand in my heart is that as I travel the world, the common refrain all the time is our IT department just don't get it. And I honestly don't know what you can do about that. I think retirement might have to take care of quite a lot of these problems. But people who have a heart for the classroom, people who are teachers, people who are interested and care about pupils and teachers' learning and teaching practice, they can see beyond the geek arguments. So like, geeks ruin everything, right? They can see beyond, you know, what about the keyboard? What about the app deployment? What about all that stuff? And make that stuff go away so that we can get the benefits that we can see down the road from having these devices in everybody's hands and everybody working on apps and freeing up people's time and people's energy and interest to do the things that they want to do and that we want to get to that we can't do because of whatever. So if I had to pick a trainee to work alongside me right now, I would take an enthusiastic computer teacher, not necessarily a computer science teacher, but a teacher who's interested in computers, and bring them along rather than taking somebody from IT and trying to make them love and care about education. That may be a strong statement, I don't know, but that's what I think about it. And I don't think there's necessarily particular skill sets that you need to know. I mean, there's obviously, I mean, we've talked on the show many times about what are the kind of core technologies, the core competencies for iOS deployment in education. And it's Wi-Fi, it's internet, it's mobile device management, and it's understanding app deployment and Apple ID structure. And I think if you've got those core things, none of which are terribly hard to learn, but there are hidden corners in there, then I think you can certainly do a lot. And I've seen teachers who don't have a lot of IT support in their schools get things up and running. Maybe not necessarily always in the best possible way, but they get something working. And crucially, they get it in the hands of kids. Because what often you see is, you know, people get one iPad and they trial it to death and they do all this stuff and then they never actually put it in the classroom. You know, they just sit there in their office and just fiddle with it and try and break it and test it and reinstall it and all that stuff. They don't actually put it in the hands of children and get them to use it for learning and teachers for teaching. So, yeah, I want to go with educational focus first and an understanding of IT rather than hardcore IT and a little bit of vagary around about education, if I had to pick. Ideally, you want both, right? But there's not that many people around who are that.
That's, you know, you want somebody that has a heart and is of the mindset of empowering people and not trying to hold the keys to the castle.
And what's really interesting is that there are people doing that in non-educational contexts as well. I think what you're starting to see at some of the more startups, perhaps, even places like Facebook, which are much more than startups now, they're doing things at an IT level there, which are not traditional, you know, complete hand-holding and stuff like that. Now, I know a tech startup's a different place because many of your users are going to be highly technical to start with, but still in all, I think there's a world coming where users can be trusted a lot more and given a lot more freedom and a lot more flexibility. And it's interesting to see that kind of culture start to come into the IT profession as well.
So last part of his question, do you think schools should have their own in-house IT specialist, or does a consultant contractor model work? I think, you know, going back to your answer about if you've got somebody, you know, if your IT department is just a, you know, a sysadmin is all he does, then, you know, that's something to think about. If all you expect of your IT department is to handle the network, you know, I blogged about that a few months ago about the coming trend of managed service providers. Mm-hmm. You know, that's an option. You know, let's say you want to outsource the kind of the just the core network aspect, and then you have a really enthusiastic teacher that you kind of want to make the on-site IT specialist, that they handle kind of the end user devices and helping control set up policies and things like that. That can work. It really just depends on the culture of the organization. And there, you know, there are even things that I outsource, like our phone system, for example. I do some of it. Like I reset voicemail passwords. I can, you know, change if you want to your voicemail to go to your email or to not. I can, you know, I can rename extensions and things like that. But when it comes to like rewiring, like if we actually need to physically move an extension to another office, I don't do that. Like I budget a certain amount every year and I call somebody. And so I think there can always be a happy medium, you know, especially like, you know, in one or two man shops, of knowing what you can do well and knowing what you do better than anybody else, and knowing what, like, you know, your local VAR can do just as good, and it can technically cost you less, whether it be phone systems, whether it be cabling, whether it be just general switch stuff. We were needing to do something on all of our switches here recently, and you know, between all the other things I have going on with these MacBook Air recalls and just some other general things, like I just didn't have time. And I thought, you know what? I've got the money in the budget for things like this. I'm just going to have somebody come in, give them a log into our switches and have them go to town. And they knocked it out in, you know, like a day. And it was, you know, again, we had to pay them, but I didn't have to spend a day doing that. I could spend my day doing the things that only I know how to do that I cannot outsource.
Time is money. For sure.
Yes.
I mean, I think one of the things that one of the ways I've seen that go very badly wrong is where schools or districts have contracted with an incredibly large company to get some kind of managed service. And this has happened very frequently in England in particular, but also in some areas of Scotland as well, where local authorities have sort of bandied together and they've signed up, like, I don't know, I'm making up the names now, but like, you know, a Centrica or a British Telecom or one of these big companies to come in and do all the network for all the schools. Right, because what happens then is that they make one design and they just stamp it out for every school. And then if you want something changed, well, you better wait till the contract gets renegotiated, because there's no way you're getting a special thing for your little school. You know, if you're the one school in a whole area that's all run by British Telecom, let's say, and you want to put iPads on your network and that wasn't in the contract 5 years ago when it was signed, well, too bad. Right? And I know there are a number of schools in various places where they're actually running like a second network that they made themselves to put their iPads on, because it's not in the contract that you can put iPads on our network and we're not responsible for that and legal and blah, blah, blah. But I think what could work for a lot of schools really nicely is working with smaller IT teams, right? So not going to the massive multinational companies or whatever, but going to, you know, a guy in your town who knows about IT. You know, I mean, I've got a friend in DC, Tom Bridge, who, I don't know if he listens, but if he does, hi, Tom. He runs a small IT consultancy where he takes on a number of clients and looks after them really well, has a great relationship with them, does a great job for them, and is super flexible and responsive to their needs. And I think that kind of model for individual schools looking at that kind of thing could work really well. But I'm pretty wary about big, big, big contracts getting signed and everything getting set in stone, because like you said, Bradley, we want to move at a pace. You know, we want to move much faster than a big multinational could move. We want to move much faster than their lawyers could renegotiate contracts and so on. And it's really hard to build in the flexibility that you really want to have if you want to move on with technology in your classroom.
Yeah. It's this is one of those situations where it's not a, there's no like perfect white paper for every school.
Yeah.
You know, you've got to know, this is where your culture matters, and this is where your leadership for your school matters. So know what you can do, and to just, you know, do it slowly, and to know what's, just know what's going on, and not just think that it's like, you know, the trend in like the bigger cities here in the States is to outsource your cafeteria. where you don't, like, you're out of it. Like, you basically get provide the facility, the parents order with the cafeteria plan, the cafeteria company, and you don't do anything. Like, you don't collect any of the money. You don't do any of it. Mm-hmm. And, is, you know, I guess that can work. But the problem is, say, let's say, for example, this is just I'm making something up. But let's say you decide we want to do a vegetarian only school. But your cafeteria contract is, hey, we have meat. Then you have like a problem there. And those are the things you run into with these big, you know, like you said, these big companies. It's like, we don't support that. That's not in the contract.
Do you want a funny story about cafeteria rules?
Yeah.
I visited a school. I'm not going to even say which part of the UK it was in, just in case, but it was a school in the UK. And we did a thing in the morning, and then we were having the school lunch, and we were in the dining hall with everybody else. And I was handed whatever the dish of the day was. I think it was macaroni and cheese and a massive bowl of fries. A huge big bowl of fries, right? And so this is a school that was promoting healthy eating. And we went through the whole line and we picked up all our bits and pieces. And then at the end, I said to the lady who was doing the checkout, I said, are there any salt sachets? And she said, no, you're not allowed to have salt because it's a healthy eating policy. But do you know what they had? The dinner ladies had, under their cash registers, they had little salt sachets from McDonald's that they had stolen and that they were handing out sneakily to staff only who went through the line. So that is a thing that happened. That's healthy eating policy in schools. No salt on your massive bowl of chips.
Yes.
But it takes a box.
Yes. Yeah. So it's yeah. That's you know, again, going back, that's there are hurdles on all these kind of things when you outsource major aspects of your school. There are hurdles you have. And again, it's not always the wrong thing. It's not always the right thing. But there are always certainly hurdles.
To my mind, just to kind of try and give people a handle on this, I think the way this breaks down is if you think you're going to have to change it frequently, you don't want to outsource it, right? So good things to outsource are things like email hosting, right? We outsource that to Google because, man, I don't want to do that. If I can create accounts and if I can suspend accounts, I don't want to deal with anything else to do with that. Just like your phone system, Bradley. But for example, I do not ever want to outsource our web filtering because I want to be able to tweak that instantly. I don't want to outsource our app installation on devices because I want to be able to change that as soon as a teacher comes to me and says, I critically need something changed. I don't want to have to phone a guy. I don't want to have to get on the phone with a lawyer. I don't want to have to get on the phone with a help desk. I don't want to have to wait for their cycle. I want to be able to, you know, drop everything and do that if it becomes a critical issue. I don't want to be at the mercy of somebody else for that. Whereas with email, you know, what's changing with email? Not that much, really. And that's what I feel about it right now. And sometimes I've kind of got on the wrong side of that as well. So, for example, I do think that one of the mistakes that we have made over the years is we've been too keen to use hosted website services. So Squarespace, or we're currently using Weebly, for example. And I think if I had the time and inclination to redo our website yet again, which I don't, I would very much lean towards hosting something. You know, maybe using a CMS, maybe using hosted WordPress or something, but something that's fully under my own control, because we've run into too many situations with these companies where they've promised us the world, they've promised us an iOS app that you can post to the blogs and stuff, and none of it ever works. It always sucks. And I just get heat from teachers all the time because we can't post our blogs, or whatever. And control the things you need to control, I think, is crucial.
I think if you could sum it up, that's a great point, that if you think you're going to change it often, you need to control it. That's a great way to sum it up. And I think that probably fits most situations.
Yeah, if it's going to change, if there's going to be a crisis with it, keep it in-house.
True.
All right. Shall we wrap it up?
I think so. Thank our sponsors again, Jamf Software, makers of the great mobile device management systems for Apple and your organization, and Aerohive Networks, the leader in cloud-managed controllerless Wi-Fi.
Mm-hmm. Can I throw in one just quick thing? Trevor mentioned about my speaking and consulting, and obviously I've been pretty busy over the past couple of months, but if anybody is planning deployments for 2014 and they want some consulting work, February, January and February would be a good time to talk to me. January, February and possibly March, because after March I'm kind of into our school exams and I can't travel as much as I would in other months I can do. So if you want to talk to me about your 2014 deployment, help you not screw it up, obviously subscribe to the show, but also if you want to consult with me, first 3 months of the year is always a good time to do it.
Sounds good. Yeah. I've watched some of your talks on YouTube and they are wonderful.
I need to get some fresher ones up there. Those are getting a bit old now. Good stuff. Where can people find us, Bradley? I'm at spears.org, S-P-E-I-R-S.org, Fraser Spears on Twitter.
Bradley Chambers on Twitter and Chambers Daily on the web.
Okay, so let's leave it there and we'll talk to you all next week.
Have a good week.